Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. Thanks for joining Ray and me for episode 32. Today's date is October 16th, 2014. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and...
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
And how are you doing tonight, Ray?
Doing fine, Carolyn. I hope you're doing as well.
Well, I am. It's been a nice day. We've had really good weather, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
We're starting with April 1st tonight, aren't we? April 1st, 1942. Isn't that what you've
my
got?
My book says April the 2nd.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm thinking about the 1st. It is the 2nd. But I've got a timeline here for the 1st. The Eastern Sea Frontier, it says, on April 1st, this is something in the United States. And then let me know if you know what this is, Ray. I'd never heard of it before. It was desperately short on suitable escort vessels after the Destroyers for Bases Agreement institutes an interim arrangement known as a bucket brigade. Well, now this Destroyers for Bases Agreement was when the United States gave 50 mothball destroyers to Britain.
Correct.
And the Eastern Sea Frontier was... Well, it was part of the whole sea frontier, and what we're going to be talking about here in a minute is the Gulf Sea Frontier. So they started a bucket brigade wherein vessels outside of protected harbors are placed in anchorages protected by netting after dark and moves on only under whatever escort is available during the day. A word of this and similar measures reaches Dönitz. German Admiral Dönitz, and he does not wait to test their effectiveness, but instead shifts his U-boats to the area controlled by the Gulf Sea Frontier. And that Gulf Sea Frontier was headquartered in Miami for guarding Florida and the Bahamas and the Gulf area, and American anti-submarine measures were not so effective. And as a result, in May, more ships will be sunk in the Gulf, many of them off the passes of the Mississippi, then off of the entire eastern seaboard.
Mm-hmm.
So they got hit pretty hard by the German submarines.
That's right.
Some of their tactics in the beginning weren't so good, were they?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Let's see. So then the other thing for April 1st is the Pacific War Council meets for the first time in Washington, D.C. It was intended to allow the smaller powers involved in fighting the Japanese to have some input into U.S. Decisions. Its purpose is soon outstripped by events, notably the collapse of the ABDA command. And the ABDA command stands for American, British, Dutch, and Australia. So they were having too many losses. They were doing too badly at that time, I think, right?
Right.
So that thing collapsed. Well, that's the kind of information you get from Wikipedia's timeline, and the others are even worse. So,
yeah,
that's all I have here. You know, I'm wondering, okay, Ray, if you should hang up and call in again, because there's quite a bit of little noise. It doesn't seem to be going away at all.
Okay, well, it's funny. On my end, it sounds clear, but I'll do that. It won't take but a second. I'll hang up and call you.
Yeah, it'll only
right
take
back
a second. Okay. All right.
Okay.
And thanks. I was thinking about it the whole time, ladies and gentlemen, that I was going through that timeline stuff, thinking this would be the time for Ray to do this, but I just couldn't make up my mind whether to do it. Here he is.
Okay.
All right. Yeah,
am
you
I
sound better.
Okay.
Yeah, so coming through very good. I'm glad we did that.
Good.
At least I hope it stays
good
this way.
Okay.
All right, so now we're on ready for you to start.
Okay, we begin on the 2nd of April, 1942, midday. In praise of the Tsar Ferdinand, Boris the Fox of Bulgaria, political plots, wisdom of Kemal Ataturk. In my view, King Boris is a somebody. There's nothing surprising about that, for he's been to a good school with his father, the Tsar Ferdinand, the most intelligent monarch I've known. If
Let
one
me just
can
clarify
reproach,
here. I'm sorry, I don't really like
now,
to
go ahead
break
yeah
in here, but I'm going to clarify here two things that I found out, checked into, and all that. King Boris is a German-Austrian on both sides, although he's king of Bulgaria.
Bulgaria. Mm-hmm.
And his father, Ferdinand, is also German, for best I can figure out, because he was born in Vienna, a prince of the ducal family of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, and that's in Austrian. And he ruled, and then he married an Austrian woman named Maria Louise. She's one of those from the royal family there. And then they had Boris. So seems like Boris is Austrian on both sides. But Ferdinand was called the Tsar. Well, he was the Tsar of Bulgaria, but I'm not sure if he was ever in Russia. See, I'm not real clear about that. But anyway, that's who we're talking about here, and he's got quite a bit to say, so I'll stay quiet now.
If one can reproach the Tsar Ferdinand with having been more rapacious than a Jew in money matters, one must nevertheless acknowledge that he was admirable as regards his audacity and decisive spirit. If we'd had him on the imperial throne of Germany instead of Wilhelm II, we'd certainly not have waited until 1914 before unleashing the First World War. We'd have acted as long ago as 1905. Just as the cunning fox succeeded after the collapse in 1918 in preserving the throne for his son, in the same way, I think he'd have found some way for Germany to save herself from the disaster. Moreover, he was an extremely cultivated man, very much above the average in all fields of knowledge. For years on end, for example, he was seen regularly at the Bayreuth Festival. Unlike what other monarchs usually do, the Tsar Ferdinand gave his son Boris a severe education, driving him on at the study of all that had to do with political and military matters. Under the rod of the old fox, the son Boris himself became a young fox who was able to work his way out of the complicated tangle of Balkan affairs. In 1919, Boris kept his throne by marching on Sofia at the head of a division, and it was always by behaving like a true soldier that he overcame the political crisis of 1934. While we're on the subject, he himself has told the story of how one night the lights in the barracks at Sofia, which had been put out at 10 o'clock, were suddenly relit at 11 o'clock and were still burning at midnight. From this, he concluded that there was a conspiracy against his life. It's a fact that until then, when an assassination was attempted in the Balkans, the assassins regularly arranged to find the politician who was to be struck at in his nightshirt. Boris, therefore, at once put on his uniform again and waited for the conspirators, sword in hand. He greeted their ringleader with the words, "You want to kill me? What have you against me? Do you think you can do any better than I can?" Thereupon the conspirators, who were completely put out of countenance, asked leave to retire to their barracks to deliberate. Boris kept their leader behind. Then he told him that he was about to appoint him president of the Council of Ministers to give him an opportunity of proving his abilities as a politician. It took less than a year, of course, for the experiment to end in the man's failure. As an end to this story, Boris made a very intelligent remark to the effect that, in a case of this sort, the worst mistake was to warn the police. "You prevent the conspirators," he said, "from seeing reason and abandoning their plot. On the contrary, you encourage them to persevere with it out of mere feeling." Alas, we must be on our guard against political assassination as much now as then. That's shown by the attempt on our ambassador in Turkey, von Papen. The attempt has a lesson for us in the fact that the conspirators realized that they'd been betrayed by the Russians who commissioned them. The principal author of the attempt had been provided, allegedly to facilitate his flight, with a machine which he was told would produce artificial fog. In fact, the machine contained a powerful explosive charge designed to liquidate the assassin himself. When this treachery on their leader's part was revealed to them, the accomplices had no scruples in telling all they knew about the objects pursued by the Soviets. For my part, I've never allowed anyone to resort to assassination in our political struggles. The method is generally inopportune and to be recommended only in exceptional cases. In fact, it cannot lead to any important success, unless it enables one to eliminate the man on whose shoulders rests the whole organization and power of the enemy. But even in such a case, I'd have refused to use this weapon. The reason why political assassination continues to be so formidable in the Balkans is that nowadays the population is still impressed by the idea that by shedding blood, one is avenging oneself. That's why Kemal Pasha acted wisely immediately after the seizure of power by proclaiming a new capital. Thus, control by the police could be exercised effectively. So.
Well, what do you think of that?
Well, I like it because the main topic of that little section was political assassination and how the Balkans are pretty well known for that back in the day and even today, I suppose. But it's Hitler's negative attitude towards it and saying that he never resorted to it and never would resort to it. So, you know, I thought that was kind of an honorable stance to take because it shows, once again, that he was not your run-of-the-mill Machiavellian politician.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does corroborate the view that the Balkans are kind of a...
unstable bunch.
Yeah, yeah, and like to avenge whatever they think is an offense, you know, has offended them or whatever. So they look for revenge. And that never ends, then, does it? Because the others have to do it, too.
It's like blood feud repeatedly, you know, going on.
Well, I thought it was pretty surprising to hear him say, if we'd had Tsar Ferdinand on the imperial throne of Germany, we'd not have waited until 1914 before unleashing the First World War. We'd have acted as long ago as 1905. I don't care for that wording before unleashing as though it was the Germans who unleashed the First World War, which is
That's pretty well
accepted that it wasn't. And and I don't think he thought it was, but yet he said this way. In this reading tonight, he says some things that... are not so very good for politically.
And I agree 100%.
Yeah. I was thinking, I wonder if this Henry Picker, the new note taker, which I said to you before when I was talking about him that he seemed to be more thorough and all of his sections were longer. You know, there was a lot more written than the other guy wrote. And I thought, I wonder if the other guy left some things out that he on his own thought weren't so good. But then I thought, you know, that I got rid of that theory because if Bormann thought that any of these things shouldn't have been said or if Bormann was censoring stuff, he would have done it, and he didn't do it. So he left all this in, so he must have thought it was okay. It was just the way they were talking. So then my next theory is that it's April 1942. Things are, Hitler's gearing up for a new offensive, and you know it's springtime and the winter's over and so on, and it's a very tough fight, and they're, you know, he's in more of a warring mood, and so maybe it's reflected here in some of the things that he says that he didn't say before, but I think some of it is a little bit what people could make quite a bit out of it if they wanted to, and then probably they have.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they would take advantage of something written like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but at least he is saying that he thinks it's better to be early than late, and he doesn't think it's good to wait for somebody else to be ready to take action. I think what he's saying is that if this guy was on the throne, he would have been sharper about things, and he wouldn't have waited until 1914 when everybody was, you know, ready to attack everybody else, but he would have started sooner. That's what I think you mean.
I do too, and to me, Carolyn, in a little bit we're going to get into a really nice section about him saying about the power of positive thinking, so to speak, you know, my words, but about you have to maintain a positive outlook and everything. And I think that was another part of it there, you know, saying that, hey, we would have jumped in this thing and gotten it in it when it was much more to our advantage than waiting around. And I think it was just another part of the positive aspect he was trying to instill in everybody.
Yeah. So. Okay. Well, so we'll go on. There's a lot of interest tonight. A lot of very much. So I do have a timeline for the second, and it is over 24,000 sick and starving troops, American and Filipino, are now trapped on the Bataan Peninsula. And the second one is Japanese make landings on New Guinea, most importantly at Hollandia. That must be something that Holland owned, like New Holland or something.
Yeah.
Hollandia. Well, all I can say is those Japanese were really going to town, and they were really tough.
Yes, that's right. 2nd of April, 1942, at dinner. Inelasticity of German protocol. Our eminent visitors get bored. Graceful customs of the French. Italian statesmen visit Berlin. What I dislike most about the Wilhelmstrasse is the protocol organization. When an official guest arrives in Berlin, protocol seizes hold of him from 6 o'clock in the morning until deep into night. They put on Faust or a showing of Tristan for Balkan types who would enjoy only a farce or an operetta. Old gentlemen who've come to Berlin to discuss important problems and who'd be the better for half a day's rest are dragged from receptions to banquets where they see the same faces everywhere. For the majority of our guests, the constraint imposed by protocol is a genuine martyrdom. Wouldn't it be better to offer them the company of some pretty women who speak their language fluently? In Berlin, of all cities, we have the luck to number amongst our actresses women like Lily Dagover, Olga Chichowa, and Tiana Lemnitz. In this respect, Boris of Bulgaria showed himself to be more of a fox than we knew. When he received the offer of somebody to pilot him through Berlin, he expressed the wish that his stay should be deprived of official character. He didn't want to put anyone out, he said. The fact was, he wanted to escape the martyrdom of protocol. He wasn't present at the showing of Faust or of another opera, but he went and saw The Poor Student and then The Count of Luxembourg. He had a royal time. When dealing with Balkan princes, one must bear in mind that they can scarcely leave their country for more than a week for fear of losing their thrones during their absence. If one bears in mind the political atmosphere in the Balkans, always heavy with threats of assassination and revolution, one must allow the political figures who come from those countries to enjoy themselves. We should offer them a show like The Merry Widow, for example, instead of those dramas chosen by protocol, almost all of which contain the inevitable scene with the dagger. I know only one Oriental prince who would allow himself to stay more than a week outside his own country. That was the old Shah of Persia. Every year before the First World War, he made a trip abroad, but he was really an exception. I also consider that protocol goes off the rails when it thinks fit to drag our guests from one museum to the next, exactly allotting the time allowed them in which to admire each picture. Without bothering about the distinguished guest's personal preferences, the guide strikes the ground with his long gold-knobbed cane, and this means it's time to pass on to the next masterpiece. As long as protocol shows so little understanding, it will merely poison our guests' lives. In Paris, the matter is dealt with quite differently. As soon as the guest arrives, the Croix d'Orsay organizes a magnificent procession with soldiers in brilliant uniform, and the whole affair is followed by a reception at the Élysée. During the next 6 days, the guest time is at his own disposal. The Parisian press, which is usually so gossipy, is extremely discreet on this occasion, a thing that greatly pleases the visitor. The latter, and all the more so if he's from the Balkans, goes home absolutely delighted with the welcome he'd had in Paris and begins dreaming of the trip he'll make next year. Since some justification has to be found for this trip, the visitor manages to wangle things so that it will be justified, and France has always profited by its way of treating illustrious guests. Before showing off their talents, our diplomats should at least try to put themselves into the skins of their Balkan visitors. The latter spend most of their time in a capital which to them acquires the look of a village where everybody knows everybody. Each of them is like a Hindu prince who, since his adolescence, has been afflicted with a legitimate wife. Consequently, when he is at last alone, the poor man heaves a sigh of relief to think that, since the discretion of the press is guaranteed, he can make sheep's eyes at a pretty woman without worrying. That's why, in cities like Berlin and Vienna, it's entirely the proper thing to give our passing guests some liberty. We've everything to gain on the political level, not to speak of the fact that it always brings in a little bundle of foreign currency. When I went to Rome, I received a most agreeable kind of welcome. The Duce saw to it that I had all the necessary time to look in peace at the works of art that interested me. As a result of that visit, I took care that the Italian political personages who came to see us should be subjected to the minimum of obligations for reason of protocol. The result was stupefying. One after another, the Italians accepted our hospitality with enthusiasm. That's what gave me the idea of proposing to Goring that he and I should grant each of them perhaps an hour of our time so as to enable them to justify their trip to Germany. The great Berlin physicians were usually sufficient to justify the rest of their time spent in Berlin. It's an interesting little take on some the things that accompany politicians and the protocols of visits to foreign countries.
Well, right. And I thought that was very humorous too. I'm sure Hitler enjoyed talking about it the way he does. But you know, he's so right, and always, and he's thinking about what he likes. You know, he doesn't want to be have every minute of his stay in another country taken over by some kind of schedule. So he realizes they don't either. But this is what the State Department, I guess what you would think, what it would be, feels they have to do in order to provide, that make sure that the visitors get to see Germany and get German culture and blah, blah, blah. But it was
pretty entertain
funny.
And impress. And, they think that's their job, to entertain and impress by taking up time. And in that last sentence there, Carolyn, where he says, the great Berlin physicians were usually sufficient to justify the rest of their time spent in Berlin. And that says a lot for the quality of the medical profession to me in Germany, that these people from the other countries might not have that at their behest. And so to me it meant that they were happy to get themselves checked out if they had any kind of ailment or whatever by a German physician.
A lot of people would come to Germany, wealthy people, you know, and world leaders, or, you know, people of great wealth would come to Germany for treatment for them or their families. So I guess that's what he's talking about there. I didn't really get that, but now you just explained it. I don't know why I didn't get it. It looks so clear now, but.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, now we go on to the 4th of April, and I've got a timeline for the 3rd and the 4th. On the 3rd, Japanese forces begin an all-out assault on United States and Filipino troops in Bataan, those starving ones, I guess, that were there, and sustained Japanese air attacks on Mandalay. So they're really hitting hard, and on the 4th, Germans plan the Baedeker raids on touristy or historic British sites in revenge for the Lübeck bombing. We talked about the Lübeck bombing last week and how terrible that was, and it angered Hitler and all the Germans so much. It was the first really terrible firebombing. And so they planned these raids, and I'm sure these are the ones that Leopold Wenger was involved with in his that he writes about in his letters home and everything on my website under Wenger Family Archive. And he wrote about some of these, and that they he called them what there's a word for wasn't for sometimes revenge and sometimes retaliation. They were retaliatory, and they were trying to also hit, instead of just hitting war targets, they were hitting historic British sites,
sure,
and touristy places. But you know what? They didn't do anything like the kind of damage. And I don't think they had it in them to do it. They didn't attack the famous churches. Only one church. Which one was it? One big cathedral got bombed, but another one that was very famous was never touched, although the town around it was bombed. And the British, you know, complain today about how terrible their bombing was.
Yes.
And really, you know, sure, nobody wants to be bombed. Yeah, there was damage and there were some deaths, but nothing like what they were inflicting. But Leopold Wenger was very... enthusiastic pilot. I mean, he's a very big German patriot, and he'd say, well, we really got him, you know, we gave him back, you know, with it. But yet I know from the historical record that they weren't able, and they didn't have those big planes anyway, and they didn't
That's
have
right.
such big plane formations. Some of them, they said they had a pretty, you know, a whole bunch of them got together, a whole bunch of those units got together, but they just had little fighter planes, and they had some bombers, I guess. But
medium-range bombers, and they weren't the huge, big ones that the Allies had. True.
No, so they couldn't do anything. And they were in the daytime. They weren't doing any night bombing then, and the British were doing night bombing. I think they were doing... Well, who was it that did night bombing? Wasn't it the British that did night bombing?
British.
The Americans did daytime bombing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So... Anyway, that makes me want to say those things. So now you go ahead with the reading on the 4th. This
okay.
is pretty good.
4th of April, 1942, midday. Japanese political philosophy, Jewish origin of religious terrorism, Jewish influence in Britain, the elite of the future, rules for a good education, cowardice of the German princes, the red flag of Canterbury, no mercy on the feeble, nature is better than pedantry, all climates are alike to the Jews, I like hard, self-opinionated men, condemnation of the pessimists, most Germans are optimists. The fact that the Japanese have retained their political philosophy, which is one of the essential reasons for their successes, is due to their having been saved in time from the views of Christianity. Just as in Islam, there is no kind of terrorism in the Japanese state religion, but on the contrary, the promise of happiness. This terrorism in religion is the product, to put it briefly, of a Jewish dogma, which Christianity has universalized, and whose effect is to sow trouble and confusion in men's minds. It's obvious that, in the realm of belief, terrorist teachings have no other object but to distract men from their natural optimism and to develop in them the instinct of cowardice. As far as we're concerned, we've succeeded in chasing the Jews from our midst and excluding Christianity from our political life. It's therefore in England and America that one can nowadays observe the effects of such an education upon a people's conduct. Our measures against decadent art have enabled us to get rid of the smears of the Jews, but these daubs, which we've banned, are at present fetching the highest prices in England and America, and nobody amongst the bourgeoisie over yonder dares to protest. One may well exclaim, cowardice, thy name is bourgeoisie. Although the Jew has seized the levers of control in the Anglo-Saxon world, the press, the cinema, the radio, the economic life, and although in the United States he is the entire inspiration of the populace, especially of the Negroes, the bourgeois of the two countries, with the rope already around their necks, tremble at the idea of rebelling against him, even timidly. What is happening now in the Anglo-Saxon world is absolutely identical with what we experienced here in 1918. The Jew, in his imprudence, can't even think where he is to interfere next. The priesthood restricts itself to the shameful exploitation of the people, and to cap it all, a king who's an utter nitwit. The King of England is worth no more than Wilhelm II, who in 1918 was trembling with fear and incapable of taking the slightest decision, his only idea being to put his flag in his pocket. Under such a monarch, the Jew can propagate and spread himself in the way he understands and instill his poison into the mind of the bourgeois world. The cream of it is that today it's exactly the same in the Anglo-Saxon world as it used to be among us. These idiotic petit bourgeois believe that no economic life is possible without the Jew, for, as they put it, without the Jew, money doesn't circulate. As if there hadn't been flourishing periods in our economic life before the intrusion of the Jews, in the Middle Ages, for example.
Boy, I reckon that's true.
Well, this stuff really hits home. I reckon that our future elite must be given a tough upbringing so that it may definitely be immunized against such cowardice. I'm in favor of an absolutely strict law of inheritance, declaring that a single child shall inherit everything and all the others shall be thrown out into life and obliged to ensure their livelihood themselves. The father who truly loves his child bequeaths him a healthy heredity and a good education. A good education consists in the following: A, forming the child's character by giving him a sense of what is good; B, giving him a background of solid knowledge; C, it must be strict as regards the object to be attained, and firm as regards the method, used. Furthermore, the father who has a lot of money must take care to give his child as little of it as possible. The man who wishes to bring up his child rightly must not lose sight of the example of nature, which shows no peculiar tenderness. The peasant class has remained healthy insofar as this form of law has been applied to the countryside. One child inherited the estate, the others received nothing or almost nothing. That's exactly the practice amongst the English nobility. The title passes to a single one of the descendants to the exclusion of all the others, by thus ensuring that the bananas don't fall from the trees into the mouths of the young people. One protects them from cowardice and idleness. I've given instructions that from now on, estates given to our colonists in the eastern territories may not be parceled out. Only the most capable son will be entitled to inherit his family's farm. The other children will have to break a road through life themselves. Such measures apply to the family as they do to other living things. Every human organism, however small, can recognize only one chief, and it is only in this way that the patrimony acquired by a family has a good chance of being preserved. As soon as it's admitted that one can't put a human being in a box full of cotton wool for the whole duration of his life, Borman is right in regarding the tough education given in our boarding schools as exemplary. The state can prop itself only on capable and courageous men. Only those who have proved their worth should be summoned to control public affairs. In the lower strata of the population, life itself assumes the task of practicing a pitiless selection. Likewise, when the popular masses find themselves confronted by rulers who are too pusillanimous, they do not hesitate to treat them with the utmost brutality. That's how one can explain that the revolution from below swept away the tottering house of cards of the monarchs of 1918. If there had been a single German prince of the stamp of Boris of Bulgaria who remained at the head of his division, declaring that he did not dream of withdrawing a single step, we'd have been spared that lamentable collapse. At bottom, destiny is indulgent and benevolent rather than the contrary. It dooms to decrepitude only what is already rotten. If only a single shoot remains healthy and strong, destiny allows it to exist. As it turned out, the poor German princes, in their panic fear, didn't retain even the power of judgment that would have enabled them to assume the inaccuracy of such a report as that of the capitulation of the Second Guards Division. The proof that things are no better in England, that there too everything is rotten to the marrow, is that an Archbishop of Canterbury should hang the flag of the Soviets from his throne. No pity must be shown to beings whom destiny has doomed to disappear. If one must rejoice that a creature as weakly as the present King of England should be irresistibly thrust downhill by the Jews, by the clergy, and by the cowardice of the bourgeois, we must likewise rejoice that our decayed potentates underwent a similar fate after 1918. It's absolutely ridiculous to take pity on our old princely houses. On the contrary, it's quite fortunate that with them disappeared the chief obstacle that still existed to the realization of German unity. In a general way, one must never have pity on those who have lost their vital force. The man who deserves our pity is the soldier at the front, and also the inventor who works honestly amidst the worst difficulties. I would add that, even here, our sympathy should naturally be restricted to the members of our national community. As in everything, nature is the best instructor, even as regards selection. One couldn't imagine a better activity on nature's part than that which consists in deciding the supremacy of one creature over another by means of a constant struggle. While we're on the subject, it's somewhat interesting to observe that our upper classes, who've never bothered about the hundreds of thousands of German immigrants or their poverty, give way to a feeling of compassion regarding the fate of the Jews, whom we claim the right to expel. Our compatriots forget too easily that the Jews have accomplices all over the world and that no beings have greater powers of resistance as regards adaptation to climate. Jews can prosper anywhere, even in Lapland and Siberia. All that love and sympathy, since our ruling class is capable of such sentiments, would by rights be applied exclusively, if that class were not corrupt, to the members of our national community. Here, Christianity sets the example. What could be more fanatical, more exclusive, and more intolerant than this religion which bases everything on the love of the one and only God whom it reveals? The action that the German ruling class should devote to the good fellow citizen who faithfully and courageously does his duty to the benefit of the community, why is it not just as fanatical, just as exclusive, and just as intolerant? My attachment and sympathy belong in the first place to the frontline German soldier who has had to overcome the rigors of the past winter. If there is a question of choosing men to rule us, it must not be forgotten that war is also a manifestation of life, that it is even the life's most potent and most characteristic expression. Consequently, I consider that the only men suited to become rulers are those who have valiantly proved themselves in a war. In my eyes, firmness of character is more precious than any other quality. A well-toughened character can be the characteristic of a man who, in other respects, is quite ignorant. In my view, the men who should be set at the head of an army are the toughest, bravest, boldest, and above all, the most stubborn and hardest to wear down. The same men are also best chosen for posts at the head of the state. Otherwise, the pen ends by rotting away what the sword has conquered. I shall go so far as to say that, in his own sphere, the statesman must be even more courageous than the soldier who leaps from his trench to face the enemy. There are cases, in fact, in which the courageous decision of a single statesman can save the lives of a great number of soldiers. That's why pessimism is a plague amongst statesmen. One should be able to weed out all the pessimists so that at the decisive moment, these men's knowledge may not inhibit their capacity for action. This last winter was a case in point. It supplied a test for the type of man who has extensive knowledge, for all the bookworms who became preoccupied by a situation's analogies and are sensitive to the generally disastrous epilogue of the examples they invoke. Agreed, those who were capable of resisting the trend needed a hefty dose of optimism. One conclusion is inescapable. In times of crisis, the bookworms are too easily inclined to switch from the positive to the negative. They are waverers who find in public opinion additional encouragement for their wavering. By contrast, the courageous and energetic optimist, even although he has no wide knowledge, will always end, guided by his subconscious or by mere common sense, in finding a way out. God be praised, in our people, the optimists are in a majority. In basing itself upon them, by the way, the church has given away its whole game. In the last analysis, in fact, the Christian doctrine is addressed to the optimist with the object of persuading him that the present life will be followed by another life, a much nicer one, on condition that he decides in time for the right creed. I nearly said for the right side. Compared with the natural objectivity of the male, the true upholders of optimism are women. They discover the most amazing qualities in their offspring within a week of their birth, and they never lose this faith. That's some good stuff.
Yeah. Yes, it is. I want to go back all the way to the beginning. Oh, Boris. I know where I want to go all the way back. He was talking about Boris of Bulgaria again. And I had some notes here that I... it was in... this is 1942, April, and I was reading about Boris of Bulgaria, and it's very interesting. And see, he was really thinking highly of Boris in 1942, and I think he always did think highly of him, but he got very angry with him in 1943. See, but this is the way a man who is the way Hitler likes, who will stand up for his views and, you know, not cave in and so on. Can often will not do what Hitler wants him to do, and but the Hitler continues, I think, to admire a man like that. But he was very angry with him because he refused to deport his the 50,000 Jews in Bulgaria. There were some Jews, about 20,000 or 11,000 or something like that, from outlying areas, and they got deported. But when it came to the ones in Bulgaria, there was a big protest, you know, by the Bulgarians. You know how that is. You know, nobody, all these people get all they don't like Jews, but when it comes time to doing anything about it, then they can't handle that. And I think, I don't think it's all just set by, you know, some Jews are creating that. I think that's in people's human nature. And this is the same thing with us today. All these people who are complaining, you know, and who will, white nationalists who will say, oh, well, the Jews are a problem. But if you ever come up with any idea of moving them out or getting rid of them, they can't. They disagree with you. Oh, no, we can't do that, you know. So you can't do anything about it if you don't. But here was Boris. He didn't want to do it then. And Hitler went over a period of time. Hitler was talking to him, and Hitler came and talked to him or sent for him or talked to him, whatever. And Boris always found some way out of it. He said he needed them. He had plucked them out of the population, it's true, and he'd put them to work fixing roads and stuff. And he said that Bulgaria needed those Jews to do that work. But that didn't satisfy Hitler, really, after a while. But he never did get Boris to do anything. And then in 1943 and 1944, the United States Air Force and the RAF heavily bombarded Sofia, but by that time, Boris had already died, because he died at the age of 49, this very strong, good man, and in August 1943, before the bombing started, so he didn't have to see that, but supposedly they found that he had been poisoned. They thought he had, you know, had been poisoned with this slow-acting poison. Because it happened shortly after he returned from his last visit with Hitler, but Hitler's not blamed for it, because it was like something that would have been given to him months before. And it appeared to be a heart failure or something, but it wasn't. So, you know, he had his enemies, and that's I thought, was an interesting story of Boris of Bulgaria. But he... Hitler had trouble with all of these Eastern European countries when it came time to actually doing the program with the Jews, as much as they didn't like Jews.
That's true, Carolyn, but you know, in my mind, this is strictly my opinion resulting from a little bit of thinking about that subject, I think every bit as much of that was, it was that way for... let's say, not such a sympathy for the Jews or like you said, certainly they didn't like them in a lot of cases. But I think a lot of it had to do with purse strings and with the Jewish influence on the business, the money, the banks, and things, and the control of such in those countries, and that the Jews who did have the influence over politicians and whatever, you know, were kind of warning them that, hey, you know, if you can stop this right here, because eventually it'll get to us, you know, we won't cut off the flow of the money or something like that. So I think that it was a factor as well as any kind of...
Well, I don't know. Bulgaria was an ally of Germany, and Germany had that same problem, but they were doing it. And I just can't see that would be it as much as their excuses that it was so they had so many of them they couldn't manage didn't want to do that with so many and they couldn't deal with what they felt was some kind of moral thing or the anger of their population maybe you know and having to pay some kind of cost on that and it might be a combination of the two. But that was, I see that still today, though, you know, and it's not, I don't think it's for that reason.
Yeah.
And just like, and you know, what I really liked in this thing tonight, Ray, was in the very first section when Hitler was saying, or what I think it was, maybe not the first section, but Hitler was saying that the people come up with their excuses. The Germans did in 1918 and during Weimar. We don't want to get rid of our Jews because they take care of the money so well, and you know we need them to do that. And what was it that Hitler said then? I'm forgetting as I'm talking. Wow. He said we had all these prosperous periods in our past, and we didn't have need the Jews for it.
That's right.
Look at the Hanseatic League that we talked about last week. You know. The Jews got in on our lucrative trade and business, and then took it over and started making all the money for themselves. That's
right.
What they did.
Yep.
Well, let's see. What did you want? Say here that I liked where he was talking about the optimist, and he said he said, if you're an energetic and courageous optimist, you're guided by your subconscious or by mere common sense, you'll always find a way out. You'll always, and that what came to mind was Hans Ulrich Rudel, who was absolutely that kind of a person who developed that philosophy early in life. And he never gave up on anything. He did amazing. I mean, God, he carried out amazing, courageous acts, and never gave up hope. And he lived through the war, through all.
He had
like over 300 missions, and he survived and carried on until he was in his 60s and died a nice natural death. So, what else stuck out for you?
That part at the conclusion, where you know he's talking about capable of resisting the trend needed a hefty dose of optimism, and then he says compared with the natural objectivity of the male, the true upholders of optimism are women, and I thought that was significant. And him saying they discover the most amazing qualities of their offspring within a week of their birth, and they never lose this faith. And, I thought it was a nice touch to conclude that.
Yeah, it was nice. You know, here's the other thing I liked was he brings up again, and he's done it before, and he does it a lot, comes up that our sympathy and our concern should be to the members of our national community,
yes,
and not to outsiders or strangers, even though you don't wish them harm. But that's not well. Here he's talking about going to the Jews, but even if it goes to others, that oftentimes are enemies or end up enemies, and they don't care. And he said these Germans, particularly these wealthy or aristocratic Germans, they don't care about their own people. And he says. talks about the thousands of German immigrants. He's talked about this before, who've had to leave the country in order to find a way to live. And these people don't. But as soon as you talk about, here we go with the deportation, with deporting some Jews or expelling Jews, oh, they have all this sympathy for these Jews. But when their own Germans have to leave the country in order to find make a living, they don't feel sorry for them. And so here once again he brought this up. I'm always glad to see that he never deserts that theme, that he cares. We need to care about our own people first. Absolutely.
Exactly.
And also his theme that that nature does not coddle anything and it's better off for it.
Natural selection.
Right. So tough. We all like to hear that. It's not as easy to actually carry it out in life, you know, as it is to just listen to it and say, oh, yeah, I agree with that. You know, it can be hard. It's hard. That's why they use that word hard. Well, okay, to go on here, for the fifth, okay, and this is a real long one, but it's the last one I read, Ray. I was kind of thinking we wouldn't get past this one. But there's a timeline for April 5th on Bataan. Now, still, the Japanese overwhelm Mount Samat, a strong point on the Allied defensive line. And the Japanese Navy attacks Colombo in Ceylon. The Royal Navy cruisers, HMS Cornwall and HMS Dorsetshire, are sunk southwest of the island. Nothing but bad news for the Allies, and the Japanese are just, I wonder when the turnaround comes for them. When does that happen?
What's that, for the Japanese?
Yeah. When does the thing start, when do their fortunes start changing?
1943.
Okay. Well, they're still going to go strong. I'm sure Hitler likes to have such a strong ally out there, giving the British such a hard time.
Exactly.
So then another one about Hitler. Hitler, on April 5th, he issues Directive Number 41, outlining his plans for the coming summer offensive in Russia. According to this, the main offensive is directed to seize the Russian oil fields in the Caucasus. Well, that's true. And a secondary thrust is to capture Stalingrad and protect the flank of the main advance. So that was his plan. I know that was his plan that he got everybody to agree to. So
You know, and about the Japanese, that the thing started turning for them via the loss of their navy in battles with the U.S. Navy, and that there was some of that later in 1942, and it accelerated in 43 because naturally you're an island country like that, and back in that day and time it. The Navy was the powerful force that transported the troops to occupy islands and invade. And when the U.S. Navy started destroying Japanese battleships and carriers and things like that, that's when the Japanese started, their offensive came to a halt, and then they became a defensive force. And that happens in a few months from what we're talking about right now. It starts to turn the other way.
Okay. Well, you know, Ray, I misspoke when I was wrong when I said this next one is a real long one, and it's the last one I did. This is midday. There's another one after this. I went through these next two.
Yeah, me too.
The other one is real long. So we'll see if we can get through it all. So I'll keep quiet here, and you just read away.
Oh, that's all right. I tell you, if you want to comment on something, please jump in there, because particularly on these longer sections, it's kind of bad to run off and leave it. So address it as you see fit. And
okay, I will.
Okay. 5th of April, 1942, midday. German patents stolen. Protection in the future. Effrontery of the Russians. The future of Finland and Turkey. Opportunities in Russia. The importance of climate. Leningrad is doomed. Addressing Professor Morel. We shall have to see to it that the French don't sell our Germanine, which was the product of so much research, under another name, and what's more, as a French product. In the peace treaty, we shall absolutely have to introduce a clause preventing the French from continuing to exploit the patents that we were compelled to hand over to them by the terms of the Versailles Diktat. In a general way, it's crazy to go on informing foreign countries in this matter through the patent office. With the exception of Brazil, a country that has never particularly distinguished itself in the field of inventions, there is no country that doesn't think itself permitted at this moment to cancel the protection associated with patents and to arrogate to itself the right to exploit ours. In future, I want German patents to be kept systematically secret.
Now, I just want to say hooray for that. Good for him.
Yes.
This is one of the things I really feel kind of strongly about.
Oh, yeah, and as much as that was exploited after World War One, you can double it for World War Two. One thing has long struck me. Countries like Russia and Japan, for example, which have no notable inventions to protect, are in the habit of applying to America, England, and Germany when there are certain products or machines that they want to manufacture themselves. They have a specimen of the article in question, a machine tool, for example, sent from each of the three countries. They procure, if possible, the relative blueprints, and then from the models they have before their eyes, they set themselves to build a fourth machine, which naturally has a good chance of being the best. A year of collaboration with Russia showed me how far effrontery can go in this field. Exploiting to the utmost the difficult situation in which I found myself, the Soviets went so far as to demand the right to buy from us location instruments intended for artillery, battleships, and even entire battle cruisers with their blueprints. At the time, the situation was such that I had to end by sending them a heavy battleship. Luckily, by temporizing and on deliveries in detail, I succeeded in not supplying them with the artillery material. That taught me a lesson that will be useful to me all my life. When Russian experts turned up at a factory to buy a machine, it sometimes happened that after having seen all that had been shown them, they had expressed the wish to examine such and such a machine prototype of which they knew both the existence and the whereabouts. Communism has created a system of espionage which even today functions admirably.
You know, I do want to say something right in here so I don't have to come back to it. He's so right there. He seems to be aware of everything. You know, Germans are a creative people, so they don't think in terms of how to steal what they need. They don't. Mm-hmm. They think, well, let's develop this, let's work on this. But those peoples who are not creative in that way, develop their talents in how to steal it, and their espionage systems are very, very good and very highly developed, and that's how they do what they do. They manage to steal the, like you said, the blueprints or the way it was done, and then they can study it and they can copy it, and they go along and get everything you had.
Yeah.
So, okay.
All right. After their first conflict with the Russians, the Finns applied to me, proposing that their country should become a German protectorate. I don't regret having rejected this offer. As a matter of fact, the heroic attitude of this people, which has spent 100 of the 600 years of its history in fighting, deserves the greatest respect. It is infinitely better to have this people of heroes as allies than to incorporate it into the German Reich, which in any case would not fail to provoke complications in the long run. The Finns cover one of our flanks. Turkey covers the other. That's an ideal solution for me as far as our political protective system is concerned. Now, I'm going to stop there because I have some comments about that. I have always felt badly that Hitler did not jump to the rescue of the Finns when the Soviets attacked them. The Finns fought heroically and gave the damn Russians hell for as small a country as they are, and that they applied for help from Germany, and Hitler decided to let them sink
or
swim
on. Yeah, but he says they wanted to become a protectorate.
Yes, yeah, there you go, a protectorate.
Not just help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
And he didn't think that would work out so well. He wasn't willing to do that. I don't know how much help they got. They must have got some help, but I don't really know. But I agree with you about the Finns. I really think highly of the Finns.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I want to point out that he said German Reich, but he's actually, the word is Germanic Reich. And in these sections, they're talking about Germanic all the time.
Yes, that's right.
It's beyond the just the German.
Yes, that's true.
He might be talking about the Greater German Reich which they started calling it after Austria was added, but they didn't even change that name right away. But eventually, the official name became the Greater German Reich. But I don't know, but I know they are, further on, they're talking about Germanic, which includes a lot of others, so.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out. Independently of these considerations, the climate of Karelia, not to speak of the other regions, doesn't suit us Germans at all. If I happen to visit our brave soldiers up there and they ask me what I think of those unproductive lands, which the Russians themselves have not attempted to colonize, I can only share their feeling. It's quite different with Norway, which, thanks to the presence of the Gulf Stream, offers much more favorable climatic conditions. So the Reichsfuhrer SS mustn't entertain the hope of replacing the Russian penitentiary colonies on the Murmansk Canal by the occupants of his concentration camps. These men's toil will first of all be needed for the building of the armaments factories we shall build in the vast Russian spaces. Besides, as regards the Russian territories that will pass under our sovereignty, the problems are so plentiful that they'll provide us with opportunities for work for several centuries. In the central sector, it will be necessary to cultivate the marshes, which extend further than I can see, by planting reeds. They'll form a barrier in future to break the extraordinary waves of cold of the Russian winter. In other parts, it will be necessary to set up plantations of cultivated nettles, for, according to the experiments made by a Hamburg firm, the fibers of these nettles enable one to manufacture a cellulose much superior to cotton. Moreover, it's becoming urgently necessary to reafforest the Ukraine in order to struggle effectively against the rains, which are a real scourge in that region. They really did a good job, those hunters who, in order to satisfy their passion for the chase, took care to reafforest 37% of German soil. In the meantime, along the whole periphery of the Mediterranean, people were deforesting without thinking of the importance of the forest and, consequently, without adopting the policy their action entailed. Since there is a question of the future of Leningrad, I reply that for me, Leningrad is doomed to decay. As one of the officers to whom I awarded the oak leaves was saying recently, famine has already reduced the population of Leningrad to 2 million. If one thinks that, according to the report of the Turkish ambassador in Russia, the city of the diplomats itself no longer offers anything decent to eat, and if one knows, too, that the Russians are continuing to eat the meat of broken-down horses, it's not difficult to imagine that the population of Leningrad will rapidly diminish. The bombs and artillery fire have contributed their share to the city's destruction. In future, the Neva will have to serve as the frontier between Finland and ourselves. May the ports and naval dockyards of Leningrad decay in their turn. As a matter of fact, there can be only one master in the Baltic, which must be an inland sea of Germany's. That's why we must see to it that there's no room for an important port on the periphery of our Reich. The development of our own ports and those of the Baltic countries will amply suffice to cover our maritime needs so that we shall be well able to dispense with the port of Leningrad, which in any case is blocked by ice for half the year. So,
okay, well, this is one of those. You go ahead.
No, I was just going to say this is, to me, just another example of his futuristic planning, where he mentions where they're going to build armaments factories. in the land that's unsuitable for growing much of anything because of the climate and things like this, that it won't sit idle. You know, he said the Russians haven't even tried to colonize that area. And he's talking about using it for armaments factories and things like this because
suitable. First he was talking about those far northern places.
Yes.
Well, I looked at where Murmansk is. It's way up there.
Yeah. Oh,
might
yeah.
as well be in the North Pole, is the way it looks. It's way up in the northern part of Finland, I mean across from it. And so they don't do anything there, but I think what he said, build armament factories in the vast Russian spaces. I think he's talking about that big area that they're planning on going through before you get to the Urals. And, you know, there is, I mean, you know, here's the thing. Russia is so huge, and
yes.
it's got really not very many people. So you've got all this area where there's nothing there, you know, nothing
yeah,
going on.
That's
You're right. Nobody's living, I guess. And maybe there's a few people here and there. Whatever, I don't know what it's like there, but they've got, I think it's 150 million population in that huge space, and isn't that right? And it may be a little more than that. The United States is 300 million, so, you know, and it's a lot bigger than the United States, and we still have plenty of room. Well, kind of.
Sure.
Not really, but...
Right.
But anyway, you know, it was like that's what he was seeing, you know, that they go, that was all being underutilized and so much could be done. And then he starts talking, I'm sure you were going to mention of the, you know, how to grow nettles for this and to grow something else for that and grow reeds to protect from the cold and all these things to make it a much more intelligent area, which the Russians never did and still haven't done as far as I know. I don't know what they do there, but I'm sure they don't do as well as what the Germans would have done had they had all that area and it worked out. That was a really ambitious idea, and I don't know if even the Germans could have kept that whole big thing going, but and you know, if everything went perfectly, I guess they could have, you know. But when he says that, he says, we'll have enough problems to keep us busy for several centuries. See, they love that, solving the problems.
Yeah.
They want to get in there and see what how they can solve the problems to make everything functioning a whole lot better. I see it positively, too, although I realize that if you're Russian, you don't. And then when he talks about Leningrad, boy, you know, the Germans get a lot of flack and a lot of... criticism hugely the National Socialist government does about Leningrad,
yes.
But he doesn't have any pity for it.
Right.
He didn't like Moscow and he didn't like Leningrad. Well, I don't know if he just started not liking Leningrad because he couldn't get it defeated, but I know he didn't like Moscow and he thought Moscow should just disappear. He thought it was too much of a nest of Bolshevism and just, you know, well.
That's right.
There's no doubt he wanted to change the whole deal there and be in charge instead of the Russians. There's no doubt about that. I think I don't know what the state of the Russians would have been, but they would have still been there. This is a hard one to talk about today.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say about it?
Well, that's true. Because of the, I guess, all of the literature that's come out or the stories about the starvation, the horrors of Leningrad and how the civilians suffered in that and everything, it's a great propaganda tool.
Right.
You know, so... Yeah,
well, he thought they should have surrendered, I guess. And he thought, what did he think? But since they didn't surrender, well, then that's, you know, that's what they got or whatever. I don't know. I don't know enough about it. I've never read, I've just superficially about Leningrad, so I've never really gone into it. And you know, everybody's biased, so you have to find an honest history about it.
5th of April, 1942, evening. Shall we try to Germanize the French? The claims of Mussert, very limited autonomy in the great German Reich. Example of Austria, Himmler on the Frisians, Germanization of Holland, the foreign legions on the Eastern Front, fusion of all Germanic races, but no excess Germanization, distrust of the Poles, traitors within, spontaneous treachery, how Germany should have shown her resistance spirit in 1918, Admiral Darlan's conjuring trick, France will pay for the errors of Versailles. During dinner, the Reichsfuhrer SS declared, this is written here by the translator. It says, it's italicized. This is not the Fuhrer speak.
By Picker. Picker does.
Yeah, yeah. During dinner, the Reichsfuhrer SS declared that, in his view, the best way of settling the French problem would be to carry off every year a certain number of racially healthy children chosen amongst France's Germanic population. It would be necessary to try to settle these children, while still very young, in German boarding schools to train them away from their French nationality, which was due to chance, to make them aware of their Germanic blood, and thus inculcate into them the notion of their membership of the great group of Germanic peoples. The Fuhrer replied, for my part...
Well, he replied, sinister theory, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it had, at the bottom there, it says, it's in quotation marks, sinister theory.
I think that's what the Fuhrer said. Yeah, I don't quite get that manuscript note by Bormann.
Bormann...
Why would that be after the Fuhrer replied?
Yeah, and I don't think it's, that sinister theory thing is Bormann, I think, wrote after, the translator wrote what he wrote. He wrote sinister theory there, about Germanizing.
Oh, I took it that fear that Hitler said at the time that Himmler was talking about this. He replied sinister theory, but kind of in a joking way. I don't know, joking is not the right word, but, whatever. That's a sinister theory.
We
don't know because this is done so damn poorly.
Yeah, Carolyn, when I was reading this, that thought never occurred to me. You picked up something here. See, I just thought Bormann had written sinister theory right there, but where it says the Fuhrer replied in my book, that happens to come right at the end of the page, and I turn the page, and then Hitler starts talking about this Germanization. But
where is sinister theory at? Because on my copy, on my internet copy, it says the Fuhrer replied, :, then sinister theory, and then in parentheses, MS note by Bormann.
Yeah. And in my book, right after it says the Fuhrer replied, which is the last line on the page, right underneath that, in a little bit smaller print, there's a one, it's a footnote, one, and then in quotation marks, sinister theory, and then in parentheses, manuscript note by Bormann. So
that's a note. That's a footnote.
Yes.
Doesn't show that. For me, there's a apostrophe where it should be, a number one, from what you're saying.
Yeah,
I see. Well, that's why it's a good thing you have the book, because that's... All right, so Bormann added something.
Yes,
he decided to add something, and he added sinister theory. Okay.
Yes.
I go along with you there on that, then.
Okay. The Fuhrer replied, for my part, all these attempts at Germanization don't mean much to me, insofar at least as no successful attempt is made to found them on an appropriate conception of the world. As regards France, one must not forget that the military reputation of that country is not due to the people's moral worth, but essentially to the fact that on the continent, the French were able to exploit certain military combinations of circumstance that were favorable to them during the 30 Years' War, for example. Every time they were confronted by a Germany that was aware of herself, they got a thrashing under Frederick the Great, for example, in 1940, etc. The fact that they won victories of universal significance under the leadership of that unique military genius, the Corsican Napoleon, makes no difference at all. The mass of the French people has petite bourgeois spiritual inclinations, so much so that it would be a triumph to succeed in removing the elements of Germanic origin from the grasp of the country's ruling class. And now, more note by the translator. Thereupon, the Reichsfuhrer SS turned the conversation upon his experiences with Mussert, the leader of the Dutch nationalists. "What struck me," he said, "is that Mussert is trying to get back his legion. He tried to explain to me that to provide a military safeguard for his seizure of power in Holland, he needed the Dutch legion, which at present is fighting on the Eastern Front. I let him have no hopes on that score, pointing out to him, on the contrary, that once the war was over, he could have in Holland only the number of soldiers corresponding to the strength of the legionnaires at present fighting on the Eastern Front. For territorial defense, he has no need of a federal Dutch army, since after the war, this defense will be exclusively our business. Nor is it necessary to maintain an important federal army for show purposes." The Fuhrer then gave his opinion. Mussert expressed himself in a rather curious fashion in my presence on the subject of the oath taken by the legionnaires, or legionaries, as it's spelled. That's why I asked him whether he supposed it was in sheer lightness of heart that I divided my Austrian homeland into several Gaue in order to remove it from separatist tendencies and incorporate it more easily in the Germanic Reich. Has not Austria, too, her own history, secular five times over, a history that truly is not devoid of highlights? Obviously, in discussing these problems, one must remain very careful when confronted by Dutch and Norwegians. One must never forget that in 1871, Bavaria would never have agreed to become part of Prussia. Bismarck persuaded her only to agree to become part of a great association linked by kinship, that is to say, Germany. Nor did I, in 1938, tell the Austrians that I wanted to incorporate them in Germany, but I insisted on the fact that Germany and Austria ought to unite to form the Greater German Reich. Similarly, when speaking to the Germanics of the Northwest and North, one must always make it plain that what we're building is the Germanic Reich, or simply the Reich, with Germany constituting merely her most powerful source of strength, as much from the ideological as from the military point of view. The Reichsfuhrer SS underlined these last words of the Fuhrer's, emphasizing that amongst the various populations assembled in Holland, there was no real sense of belonging to one community. It's observed, for example, that the Dutch Frisians don't feel attracted as far as kinship is concerned towards the other Dutch. Nor does one find in them a Dutch national sentiment found on a solid idea of the state, founded on the solid idea of the state. It seems the Dutch Frisians would much prefer to be united with the Frisians from the other side of the Ems, to whom they are akin by blood. Field Marshal Keitel supported this point of view on the grounds of his own experience. He estimated that the Frisians beyond the Ems desire only one thing, namely, to be united with the Frisians on the near side of the Ems in a single administrative unit. The Fuhrer, after taking time for reflection, said that if this were so, the best thing would be to join the Frisians on both sides of the Ems in a single province, and that he would mention the matter to Seyss-Inquart when occasion arose. The Reichsfuhrer SS then spoke of the creation in Holland of boarding schools for the political education of the young, two for boys and one for girls, to be called Reich schools, a title approved by the Fuhrer. A third of the pupils would be Dutch and two-thirds German. After a certain period, the Dutch pupils would have to visit in turn a similar school in Germany. The Reichsführer SS explained that to guarantee that instruction would be given in accordance with the purposes of the Germanic Reich, he had refused a financial contribution from Holland and had asked Schwarz to set aside a specific sum exclusively for the financing of these schools. There was a project for the creation of similar schools in Norway. They, too, would be financed solely by the Reich Party treasurer. If we want to prevent Germanic blood from penetrating into the ruling class of the peoples whom we dominate and subsequently turning against us, we shall have gradually to subject all the precious Germanic elements to the influence of this instruction. The Führer approved of this point of view. Now back to Hitler speaking. In any case, we must not make a mistake.
I don't know if this goes on with the same time. I think they're talking about the checks and polls now. I think maybe we should comment a little bit on this part
okay.
that we just said. Do you think?
Sure.
Just let's see. See what they're talking about is they're talking about creating this Germanic Reich. But they really, they're talking about maybe a prelude to the Germanic Union or something, a Germanic order ruling Europe or whatever. But I think, and they're concerned that those Germanic peoples, like the Dutch and those who are in France that they find and elsewhere, that they have, that they're loyal, that they have the same ideas. You know, that they're Germanized, you know, and that they go along with it. And so they, you know, have the schools and during the schools and all of that. Now, this can is another area where those who don't like it, and most of the Dutch are against all this. So they say, look what he's trying to do. And in Norway, too, they're doing it. So that those are two of the areas that they thought were best for being a part of this German ruling order or whatever, and governing order. And so this is also very, very controversial, and it's not given much attention when people are defending Hitler and Germany on all the other things that we know about so much. And this is not given too much attention. But it's coming up here. And I'll say that Himmler was, I just like that Himmler more all the time. And he was very into the German people, the German culture and German ways and so on. And so he would really get into this Germanization stuff. Well, that's what they were doing. Well, you want to comment anything on it, or should we just go on, whatever?
No, I think you covered it quite well, and it's all involving that Germanic Reich, people of a blood kin, you know, uniting, and the way to do it, schooling, and make them aware of their Germanic blood and heritage. So
yeah, they would say that's genociding them. They're destroying their culture and them. But they're looking for the ones that fit. You know, they're not looking for anybody. The ones that are actually willing. You know, although they're also talking about children in school. But I don't know how young they are. But so Well, I would like to know more details about it. It's pretty interesting. So we'll go on.
In any case, we must not commit the mistake of enlisting in the German army foreigners who seem to us to be worthwhile fellows unless they can prove that they're utterly steeped in the idea of the Germanic Reich. While we're on the subject, I'm skeptical about the participation of all these foreign legions in our struggle on the Eastern Front. One mustn't forget that unless he is convinced of his racial membership of the Germanic Reich, the foreign legionary is bound to feel that he's betraying his country. The fall of the Habsburg monarch clearly shows the full size of this danger. On that occasion, too, it was thought the other peoples could be won over, Poles, Czechs, etc., by giving them a military formation in the Austrian army. Yet at the decisive moment, it became obvious that precisely these men were the standard bearers of rebellion. That's why it's no longer appropriate to build the Germanic Reich under the standard of the old Germany. It's not possible to unite the Germanic peoples under the folds of the black, white, and red flag of the old German Empire, for the same reason as prevented the Bavarians from entering the German Reich in 1871 under the flag of Prussia. It's the reason why I began by giving the National Socialist Party, as a symbol of the union of all Germanics, a new rallying sign, which was valid also inside our own national community, the swastika flag. Let's avoid attempting the Germanization of our vital space on too great a scale. Let's be cautious, especially with the Czechs and the Poles. According to Himmler, history proves that the Poles have their nationality tattooed on their bodies. They must therefore be kept under control by giving them the strongest possible stiffening of German officers and NCOs, and by trying to have them outnumbered by the German elements. It was agreed with Frank, the Governor General of occupied Poland, that the Krakow district, with its purely German capital, and also the Lublin district, should be peopled by Germans. Once these two weak spots have been strengthened, it should be possible to drive the Poles slowly back. I don't believe it's necessary to proceed with much circumspection in this field, for we would be condemning ourselves to renew an experience we already had after the divisions of Poland. The soul of Poland remained lively because, on the other hand, the Poles hadn't...
On the one hand, the Poles hadn't
to take the Russian domination seriously, and on the other hand, they had succeeded in putting themselves politically in a strong position, with the Germans being helped in this by their allegiance to a Catholicism deeply tinged with politics. One can even say that the Poles played a decisive role in German home policy. It's very important for the future that the Germans don't mingle with the Poles, so that the new Germanic blood may not be transmitted to the Polish ruling class. Himmler is right when he says that the Polish generals who genuinely put up a serious resistance in 1939 were, so to speak, exclusively of German descent. It's an accepted fact that it's precisely the best elements of our race who, as they lose awareness of their origin, add themselves to the ruling class of the country that has welcomed them. As for the elements of less value, they retain the characteristics of their ethnic group and remain faithful to their Germanic origin. The same caution is necessary towards the Czechs. They're skilled at not awakening the distrust of their occupiers and are wonderful at playing the role of subjects. It's true they've had 5 centuries' experience of it. I saw them at work in Vienna during my youth, arriving penniless and dragging their worn-out shoes over the streets of the city. They quickly acquired the Viennese accent, and one fine day one was quite surprised to see them installed in the key positions. We shall not win the peace on the racial level unless the Reich knows how to maintain a certain stature. Confronted with the United States, whose population is scarcely greater than ours, our strength lies in the fact that 4/5 of our people are of Germanic race. The attitude of our rulers after the collapse of 1918 was truly inconceivable. Numerous industrialists had at that time tried to conceal a portion of our weapons from the enemy, and these weapons were the more precious than in that they represented the result of the efforts due to the patience and perseverance of our searchers. Far from supporting and encouraging these industrialists in their activity, our governors created 1,000 difficulties for them, going so far as to accuse them of betraying the interests of the country. And yet, it wasn't difficult to evade, to a certain point, the conditions of the Versailles Diktat. The controls were not so easy to carry out, and who'd have detected in the course of a checkup that there were only 30,000 guns instead of the expected 50,000. There were, in fact, 30,000. There is no doubt at this moment the spirit of treachery was rampant in Germany. Why didn't our rulers all treat the traitors as Pohner and Frick did in Munich? As a matter of fact, thanks to the microphones installed in the seats of the Enemy Disarmament Commission, they sometimes succeeded in catching the traitors at work. When they did so, they at once had them hauled in by officials of the criminal police, who passed themselves off as French, and at once arrested them. If there had been any desire seriously to oppose the disarmament of Germany, the Treaty of Versailles itself offered us the possibility of doing so. Nothing was stopping us from building a great number of fast motorboats, since the building of units of that tonnage was not forbidden to us. As for warships, we could have set their tonnage well above the officially admitted figures. Have you heard it said that it has been observed that my heavy cruisers do not at all correspond to the official measurements, particularly as regards their draft? With a little know-how, one could have turned that army of 100,000 men into a genuine school for officers and NCOs. By fixing the duration of military service at a small number of years, it would have been possible to train enough men to dispose, in case of need, of 800,000 to 900,000 men. Obviously, such responsibilities cannot be entrusted to cowards. The first time I gave the order to resume the building of 21-centimeter guns, some timid fellow regarded my order as being for 6 guns instead of the 60 I was ordering. I had to make these gentlemen understand that as soon as one exceeded the stipulations of the treaty, it mattered little whether one did so by small or by great percentages. In the same way, it would have been possible to build concrete forts along the Franco-German frontier and camouflage them as caves for children's homes, hospitals, etc. Thus, in the event of conflict with France, we'd have had a system of fortifications comparable to our West Wall. Nowadays, it's the duty of our high command to make sure that the French aren't playing this game on us. I was struck by a formula used by Admiral Darlan in an appeal to the French. Side by side with matters of no consequence, he spoke of precautions for the future as if he were referring to one of the objects of his policy. Unfortunately, I haven't had an opportunity of asking him to explain this mysterious statement. In any case, I could have drawn his attention to the fact that he seems to be hatching certain ideas that were not unfamiliar to me at the time of my struggle. And I'd have added that the tricks of a small conjurer cannot deceive a master conjurer. It will be France's fate to atone for the era of Versailles for the next 50 years. So.
Well. We got through that in pretty quick time. You know, I would say just right off the bat that nobody should think that Hitler wasn't tough. You know, so many people are trying to dream up this image of this friend of everybody or something, you know, and spent all his time talking to children or something.
right.
He did like children. Of course, he saw the future in children. But he was tough, and in 1942, he was still tough. He wasn't declining. He saw everything as it was, and you know what? What I see this as revealing is that they know that they've had these same people as enemies throughout the past, going back at least 500 years or longer, really,
yeah.
But they've learned their lessons, and if they want to succeed at protecting Germany and creating a Germany that is... He didn't insist on such a dominant Germany, I think, until the British and French declared war on him. And then once you get into war, well, then, you know, things change.
Yeah.
And so you say, well, okay, I've got to take care of this, got to take care of that. So in needing to take care of all this, the policy was Germans first. And we need to make sure that we don't have a bunch of traitors in our midst because we're incorporating non-Germans into our government as managers. All these careful things were being done, and I do think that, of course, this is all Hitler speaking, but I think that Himmler was quite a bit involved in a lot of this thinking of how to go about it. I like the feeling of strength of it and not being a... One thing I hate most of all is if I think that the Germans are being patsies. And, of course, the Germans of today, it's so pathetic, some of the stuff they do, you know. So go ahead, Ray.
No, I was just going to say that he's obviously discussing the treaties, terms of the Treaty of Versailles, and how Germany was limited to a 100,000-man army or protective force, which put them at an extreme disadvantage to anybody that wanted to invade the nation, and to a certain number of arms. And when he brings out the fact that some of his industrialists were trying to conceal a portion of their weapons, you know, from those administering those treaty diktats, so that Germany would have a supply of weapons if indeed they had to defend themselves, that some of their own politicians, or he said governors, you know, accused them of betraying their country or doing damage to Germany by trying to, on the sneak, have more weapons than they were supposed to have. And, you know, and this was shocking and dismaying to Hitler, as it would have been to any real patriot. But so it was a good discussion of what the Treaty of Versailles, how it handcuffed Germany and really.
Yeah, and they were all going to accept it. They thought they had to accept it, as you just said.
Yes.
And Hitler, right from the start, I don't know, I don't think he ever did. He never accepted that. Not ever.
No.
And so right from the start, he thought, you know, if he had power, he would do something about it. He didn't have the power to do anything. But, you know, when he finally got some, he started breaking. He started doing what he wanted to do, and heck with this treaty. And, you know, most of them, then they went along with it because they knew that any decent people would do that because it was a terrible treaty.
Sure.
So, you know, he got respect, actually. It was... But these timid Germans, he said, and were just expecting to be abused and continue to be abused, and they were just putting up with continuing abuse, I guess. And they, so many of them still think they deserve it.
Makes
you sick.
It does, and some of the right-thinking men on the Allied side at that time, and I'm talking some powerful military people as well as politicians, mm-hmm. France, England, whatever. Made the remark, shaking their heads, that this treaty is creating the basis for the next war.
Mm-hmm.
Because they knew that no self-respecting nation could subject itself to that kind of domination and ruin. And so there were some right-thinking people outside of Germany in the Allied nations that knew that that was a force that was going to come back and bite them. So, but anyway, hey, it's been a good study tonight, and I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, all right. Me too. So we'll close for tonight and invite people to come back next week. Do you have any idea what's on the agenda for next week, Ray, that you can say real quick? Or I didn't even look ahead.
No, this is as far as I had read, too, so our timing was exquisite. I know that Pastor Niemöller is mentioned in the next section. So.
Oh, that'll interest me.
That'll
interest me, all right. Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening. We will be back again next week.